If you negotiate with your knee before standing up, you're losing that argument. Joint Relief Institute treats joint pain fast. And yes, it's covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000 as in zero pain.
These guys have earnings coming up next week.
Then you got the labor. I mean, the labor here is tremendous. I mean,
15.3% is the number, which is alarming.
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch, sponsored by Wintrust, Chicago's bank, on 720 WGN.
It is 12:12 here on a Tuesday afternoon. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Steve Bertrand in the Skyline Studio, high above the Chicago River on this afternoon. We're going to talk a little bit. You know, we talk a lot about diversity here, about hiring and how that benefits people in the workplace. Well, what about when it comes to economists? There recently, in fact, just yesterday was a symposium about the diversity or perhaps lack of diversity when it comes to federal government economists. What does that mean? We'll look into that a little bit later. I'd like to start on Tuesdays, though, with John Najarian from CNBC and the Najarian Family Office. He joins us from sunny Laguna this afternoon. John, welcome back to the Biz Lunch.
It is always great to be with you, Stephen. Thank you.
Now you sort this out for me. The Dow is down 195 points. I have seen four or five different explanations. One was the lack of consumer confidence or the drop of that. The increased impeachment talk was another. The Britain Supreme Court ruling was the third. What is leading to this drop this afternoon?
I would say the first two and the Britain, the basically rejection of Boris Johnson being able to shut down Parliament, that is probably having very small impact on U.S. markets. But I think the other two, the impeachment talk as well as consumer confidence falling off rather dramatically, because you and I have talked about how the consumer is indeed 70% of the economy. I'm a guy that always likes to follow the money, so I'm saying I care more about that 70% than the 30% represented elsewhere. But when that 70% makes a significant change to their opinions, then I pay attention, and I think a lot of people did today as well.
Have you looked deeply into the numbers at all? I mean, do you know why it is that we're less confident? Because this is what we've been talking about, this idea of talking ourselves into bad news or into a bad situation.
Right. I would suspect that this polling that came out with this negative reading was during the really volatile trade talk and walking away from trade talks and all the rest that had the markets rather riled. And so I believe that would be what consumers were focused on when they, as poll, dropped their opinion of how optimistic they were.
All right, this Ukraine story seems to be an important one. Then Senator Durbin came out today saying he would favor an impeachment inquiry. And then Joe Biden did as well. I think he said if the administration wasn't forthcoming with documentation. Why is it or how is it that the impeachment, the elevation of impeachment talk is hitting the market today?
Because of the headline grabbing news that the president had this conversation and that a week before he had withheld military aid to Ukraine. Now, he and the person, the president of Ukraine, are two of the many, many people who know what went on that phone call. Because as you might imagine, Steve, there's a lot of people listening on our end.
Yeah,
legitimately
right.
Listening, probably even translating in some cases. And then there are the same on the other side of the phone. So who knows how many people have heard this? And the question is, of course, is this what Senator Durbin referred to when he said he would support that investigation if indeed there were a quid pro quo? And that's what it all centers on. If there wasn't a quid pro quo, then this is yet another thing that is probably going to bounce off the Teflon president.
Well, even if there is, lots bounces off. But so the allegation here is that he was holding up on some loans until the new president would perhaps investigate Joe Biden's son, right? That's kind of what we're talking about.
That's exactly okay. It. Yep. Hunter Biden was working for a big oil and gas company in Ukraine, and he was being investigated on a variety of charges. And allegedly, Joe Biden stepped in and withheld money at that time to keep his son from being, or to get the prosecutor tossed on that case.
Okay, so you are at a family, the year from the Nigerian family office, stuttering there, but you're at a family office convention in California, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm hosting for Institutional Investor magazine,
well,
the
was
100 largest family offices.
All right, well, they were written about, in a way, I think, in this UBS survey, looked at 360 global family offices with an average family wealth of $1.2 billion. 55% of them expect a recession next year. 45% of them are already moving their money, 42%, into cash reserves. Is that what you're picking up out there as well?
We talked about that survey. We talked about others that pointed in a similar direction. And then we just had somebody from Ned Davis Research come up on stage literally minutes ago. And she said that their work shows that it's at least a year out, maybe a year and a half out. And obviously there would be some pretty substantial gains that people would miss, because she also showed that after the first rate cut, the market on average, 18 of the last 21 times the Fed has made a rate cut, an initial rate cut, the market has rallied by 16%. So that would be a lot to leave on the table, trying to time when a recession might hit.
And from what I know of you, you tend to be in her camp, right?
I am. Yeah. Yep. I'm in the camp with her, with Martin Zweig, with a host of other folks that say don't fight the Fed. In other words, stay with this until and unless the Fed changes its direction on interest rates. And globally right now, it's not just ours, but globally, 82% of central banks around the world are in a loosening mode, not in a tightening mode.
And it's interesting, we're going to talk about the diversity of economists at the Fed coming up in just a couple of minutes. But before we say goodbye to you, what are you looking at today?
Well, I still love Apple. I think a lot of people love this new phone, the Pro in particular. And I think one of the reasons, Stephen, that this is what Apple did, putting three cameras on there, is that they make so much money off of that data that we store in the cloud. And whether it's $5, $10, $15 a month, depending on how much storage you need, the more pictures you take, Stephen, the more data storage you need. And that's why it's a brilliant ploy to get more money in their services sector, which is the highest percentage profit of anything that Apple sells.
In other words, Apple still has got us coming and going.
Yes, they do, sir.
John Najarian, thanks for joining us. Let's do it again next week.
All right. Thank you, Stephen.
You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. All right, we talk a lot about diversity here on this program. When it comes to people on the boardroom, people in the workplace, people taking STEM classes in high schools and colleges. But what about economists? That was the topic of a symposium yesterday at the Hutchins Center on Fiscal and Monetary Policy at the Brookings Institute. A senior fellow in that group is Louise Shaner, and she joins us on a phone line now. Louise, welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, you know, it's not something I had thought about, but tell me about the importance of diversity when it comes. And we're talking about economists here working for the federal government in general and the Fed specifically, correct?
Exactly. So we're talking about PhD economists, and the lack of diversity in the economics profession has gotten really a lot of attention in recent years, but most of the attention has been focused on academia, on colleges and universities. And so we wanted to broaden the discussion to the huge set of economists that work for the federal government. So we held an event yesterday, and before the event, what we did is we actually gathered the data, because we know some of the data from academia, but we did not have the data for the federal government. And so we got data from the Federal Reserve System, the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Reserve Banks, and then we gathered data across agencies like the Department of Agriculture, Treasury, Health and Human Services, Congressional Budget Office.
What did you find? Was it a bunch of white guys coming up with the numbers, or what did you find?
Okay, so what we found is that in terms of female versus male, 30% of the economists in the federal government are women, which is, you know, less than half, but it is higher than what you see in academia, which is closer to just 23%. And in terms of non-whites, is the only breakdown we could get, was white, non-white.
Mm-hmm.
24% of the PhD economists who work for the federal government are non-white, which is a little bit better than academia as well. Neither of these numbers are great, though, right? There's really a lot of room for improving diversity within the profession at the government level as well as in academia.
Yeah, but it isn't. You know, if you had asked me to guess before talking to you, I would have thought that the government was trailing academia. Were you surprised that the government's actually leading a little bit?
I wasn't actually surprised, and I thought actually probably it might be leading even more, especially with women, because one of the things that you hear is that for women, the tenure clock, right, which is that you have to like produce as you, when you're first hired, doesn't really work very well with motherhood. And whereas I think there's less of a sort of time constraint in that sense. In government, so I actually thought the numbers might be higher. So they look pretty similar, just a little bit better. So I thought that was interesting, but no, I wasn't surprised about that direction.
Yeah, but we're still talking about two sort of bad lunch choices. I mean, the numbers
exactly
aren't where they should be. And so, how does that impact us with that bad lunch?
So one of the things, we actually had Janet Yellen, who's the former chair of the Federal Reserve and who is now a scholar at Brookings, open the conference, really a discussion about why this is so important. And this is important for various reasons. One, of course, is just pure fairness. We want to have a profession that's open to everybody, and to the extent that it doesn't feel that way, and people don't feel welcome, that's just a fairness issue. But also in terms of how it impacts everybody else. First of all, we're leaving incredibly good talent on the table when people who could be wonderful economists and contribute to society aren't going into the field. And I think most importantly, you know, economics is really about everything, right? It's about our institutions, labor markets, health, monetary policy. There's just so many things. And the more diverse the set of voices and perspectives, the more the economics is going to sort of be useful for society and reflect the issues that are important.
Tell me a little bit about that. But tell me about that, because, Louise, the numbers, if you're looking at it, you could say, well, the numbers are the numbers. It doesn't matter who's compiling the numbers. Why does the race or gender of a particular economist alter what we find out?
Well, so it depends on what you study, right? So there are a lot of things that one could study. If you look at what women, for example, tend to study, they tend to focus on different topics like health insurance, health care, the labor market, family, children, you know, what kind of government investments in children yield long-run results. These are incredibly important public policy questions that women just tend to gravitate to. And so if you want to have a broad set of questions addressed by economists trying to think about what the research shows from an economic perspective, then you really want to have a broad set of voices. Similarly, in terms of how you characterize how's the economy doing, well, there's different ways of looking at it, right? You can look at GDP overall. You could look at income distribution. You could look at different groups of people. And so I think that everybody comes, you know, to anything they do with their own set of perspectives and background, and so bringing those different perspectives is really important. Also, like actually, Janet quoted Christine Lagarde in a sort of joke, which was, if Lehman Brothers had just been Lehman Sisters, we might not have had the financial crisis. But there is research showing, first of all, that women tend to be more risk averse than men, and I think more importantly that when you have diversity of views around a table in the workplace, in academia, you know, you get less groupthink. You get fewer blind spots. So if we think that, you know, that crisis maybe should have been foreseen, you know, the one wonders if you just had more different perspectives around the table, you know, what might have been the result.
Louise,
so I think we think it is important.
Louise Shaner is a senior fellow and policy director at the Hutchins Center of Fiscal and Monetary Policy. That's at the Brookings Institute. And she's on a first name basis with Janet Yellen. Not too bad. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Jordan Bernfield. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN, sponsored by Wintrust Chicago's Bank. In the studio is Holly Buckendahl. She's the CEO of Ronald McDonald House here in Chicago. Holly, welcome to the Biz Lunch.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, thank you for the work that you do. It must be pretty rewarding.
It is very rewarding.
I got married at St. Clement's Church 25 years ago.
Oh, my goodness.
And so I knew of Ronald McDonald House as being In that old an old convent,
that's right?
Next
that's exactly
to the church.
Right.
And because Children's Hospital used to be right across the street, or
yes.
not too far.
Yes.
That was the first in the area?
It was. It was the second in the world, too.
Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
The first was in the Philadelphia area?
Right. So it was really Chicago that launched mm-hmm. kind of really the movement. As
to make it
hospital.
Grow and everything.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
How many are here now?
We have 5 Ronald McDonald houses here in the Chicagoland area.
Okay. And how does that compare with other metro areas?
Yeah, we're one of the largest. Yeah. Second, third largest in the world.
And then there are also, because there's one right behind us, isn't there?
There is, yeah.
At the new Children's Hospital.
Absolutely.
And then you have playrooms as well, or explain that for me.
Yeah, so, you know, the house really in your backyard here is soon to be 70 bedrooms. We're adding 4 bedrooms that will open in a couple of weeks.
Wow.
But it's a big house. And so everything that that you and I do in our own home, we do in the Ronald McDonald House. So it has completely all the same amenities.
Amenities.
Really, I can't even say that
that's
today.
Okay. It's got some anemones, too. I'm sure it does, yeah.
So, you know, we're just trying to keep parents close to their sick kid.
I guess we should start with that. I mean, I didn't really explain your mission, but tell us what it is that you do and why it's so important.
Yeah, well, you know, we believe that when a child is sick, a family is sick. And so our mission is really to keep kids and families close together and help them get better together. And so we partner with our pediatric hospitals in the Chicagoland area to make sure that those critically ill kids can have their families close. And so, you know, whether you live in Naperville or, you know, in an area that is too hard to kind of get back and forth
right.
To be bedside or be near a child, you can stay at the Ronald McDonald House.
It's a healthcare system in a way.
Absolutely.
I mean, the children, I would imagine their recovery benefits by having family nearby.
That's right. So, you know, if we can help families be nourished and taken care of and have a good night's rest, then they can go back, you know, and redo their cycle the next day of being near their child. And they're part of the medical decision, the treatment team.
How far away is the typical guest? I mean, how far away do they live?
You know, our average is probably 4 to 6 hours.
Right.
So we serve families from all over the world. Last year, we had families from 45 different states. But
here in Chicago.
Here in Chicago, we're primarily serving Indiana and Illinois.
Okay.
So I would say about 50 to 60% of the families using a Ronald McDonald House in the Chicagoland area are from those two states.
And I didn't know you had sort of a mobile office, or you have a mobile system. Explain that for me.
Yeah, we have a great partnership with Advocate Children's Hospital, and we do mobile medical outreach to children to get them access to care in underserved areas. So our primary partners are with schools and trying to make sure that we help them stay in school. So a lot of early detection, screening, immunizations, and we do a lot of dealing with what I would call food insecurities. So we'll see about next year.
Explain
probably.
That. What is that, food insecurities?
Maybe lack food nutrition at home.
Okay.
May not
so
eat for 2 or 3 days. Just getting them some basic food
uh-huh.
support. So we have a backpack program that when you get on the care mobile and the social worker or the nurse at the school has identified that perhaps there is a food challenge
uh-huh.
at home and getting access, we make sure we send that kid home with a backpack.
How many kids are affected by that every year or impacted?
This year we'll probably reach about 6,000 kids.
Wow.
So it's a great partnership that we do. And, you know, we're part of that healthcare continuum of making sure that those kids get seen and find a healthcare home, quite frankly.
So, I want to ask you about, there was trouble last year or earlier this year down at the University of Chicago Hospital, right? The facility there
right.
had a devastating flood. Where are you
right.
with that?
We are scheduled to open October 1st.
Nice.
So it's been a long haul. It's been closed since February. We were part of the victim of the polar vortex and experienced some extreme weather conditions with our pipes and our sprinkler system that really did destroy the inside of the house. And it was fast. And so about a $2.5 million loss. And the community really rallied around us, and we are so grateful for that.
And so that's going to open up soon.
It's going to open for 22 families. We'll welcome back who we have been putting at a hotel since February.
We talk here about taxes and debt tax donations, and I'm interested in charities, whether they've seen a drop-off in their donations with the new tax laws. There's less incentive tax-wise to donate.
Yeah.
Have you noticed anything like that?
Yeah, I think we're still a little bit in the learning curve. I think this was the first year that people really realized what was happening with their own tax situation. And so, you know, I think that we ended up maintaining who I would say is our loyal base
right.
of donors. And we have maybe some limitations now on, you know, what would be new donors to us and people getting interested, because I think that as people are affected based on their circumstances, they are staying committed to maybe what their core charities are, but maybe the room for growth And supporting others has become more limited.
Yeah, I think that. Well, look, I'll just say for myself, because I'm a Scrooge and miserly, but the sort of peripheral donations aren't as attractive to me as they would have been if I had a tax donation. My core ones certainly are.
Absolutely.
But the ones walking down the street, I'm a little less likely. That's got to be a challenge for people like you to excite us and to warm our heart a little bit.
Yeah, I think, listen, as things change like this, you know, we all adjust. And we're just working hard to make sure that we're reintroducing our mission to folks who may not know about us, which is this conversation today is helpful.
Right.
Kids are going to get sick. And families need your support. And so we don't have the luxury of sitting back and not being aggressive at finding donors and getting them to continue to give.
I knew that you welcomed families. I didn't know you went to the schools.
We did.
And helped kids there. That's outstanding.
Do. Yeah.
Thanks very much for coming in. Holly Buckendahl is the CEO of Ronald McDonald House. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN.
Start the timer, because here's the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing and examining Chicago business news of the day. And if you take a look to your left, right over the little thing we call Lake Michigan, you'll see Detroit. The auto capital still seeing some pushback from the United Auto Workers Union this week as they enter the second week of their strike. But GM is looking to hold out since they temporarily laid off 1,200 employees to cut back on costs. The total number of workers that have been temporarily laid off is at 4,500. And the kicker is that most of those workers aren't union employees. Oof, that's some cutthroat business strategy right there. Wow, hey look, union workers are striking. Huh, I guess someone should figure that out. Johnson, you're temporarily fired. What? What did I do? But if you want to focus on startups, then Cameo is probably this year's poster child for the community. They won the 1871 Momentum Award this week. It's an award given to a company that's seen significant growth, funding, and quote, makes a substantial impact in the tech scene. It raised $50 million this summer, and they aren't slowing down for anybody. Some of the celebrities they've got on board are Ozzie Guillen, Charlie Sheen, Gilbert Gottfried, and so many more. It's worth a check out. I'm Bennett Wakenight, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Thanks, Orion Samuelson. You know, all that talk about pork and everything made me hungry. I have an idea for maybe a cider-braised pork shoulder. I was reading the recipe in Bon Appetit magazine, and I wonder if there was a way to get it delivered to my door.
You're in luck. There is.
Amy Guth, the host of The Daily Gist, is in the studio, the podcast from Crane Chicago Business. And so now I can read a magazine article on a food product or a recipe. Rather than go buy the ingredients and make it myself, I can have it delivered to my door?
That's right. So today, Let Us Entertain You and Bon Appetit have announced that they're teaming up with Grubhub, and they're creating a delivery service based on recipes that are in Bon Appetit.
So I was calling it a pop-up before, but it's not a pop-up. It's a virtual restaurant.
It's a virtual restaurant. And this is the second one that Let Us has done. And their position is that similar to other restaurants. And the idea is, you know, you don't have to necessarily open a whole restaurant. You can use existing kitchen space and run a virtual restaurant out of that. So they're going to be using two of their existing spaces to run this out of.
And Bon Appetit, there'll be limited recipes, right? Not every recipe in each magazine you can order. A few neighborhoods, not every neighborhood.
Right, yeah. For now, it's Lincoln Park, Lakeview, and River North. They're going to do that. Hopefully,
because they're all starved. Those areas are starved for restaurants to begin with.
There's nothing to eat there at all.
Okay, so what I don't get, but there are others who do this, like we talked with, it was my friend Raman, Bennett, if you remember, the guy who would do the pop-up, the Armenian egg rolls was by.
I don't know what that is, but it sounds good.
Yeah, it's called Rolled Up. And he came in, and he was sort of would go to, he didn't have a food truck, but he'd do pop-up stuff where, you know, so he could presumably deliver to you.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't a unique thing that they're doing, or is it a unique thing?
It kind of is. It's sort of the next wave of that, right? Like food trucks were like, well, we don't have millions to open a restaurant, but here we can still serve food to the public in this way for less. And then we started seeing pop-up restaurants where it's like, I won't do this for the long haul, but maybe for 1 week I will serve this food. And now this is like, you know, the restaurant is just online. You can just see what the menu is there online and make your order and it will come to you.
It seems to me that this story is really about the giants getting involved in what the midgets or the short people or the small businesses have been doing for some time.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, and I think it's another revenue stream for a lot of restaurants that, you know, are trying something new that maybe don't have a, but to think of opening a restaurant with Bon Appetit, that would be a huge endeavor. It would take a long time. But now they can start it really quickly just by getting those recipes ready.
Listen, I'd love to continue the conversation, but the Grubhub driver's downstairs.
We got to go get our food.
This and more on The Daily Gist coming up today?
Yes, lots more.